Hello, I'm Steve Wiggins, and this is podcast number 12 of the Sects and Violence in the Ancient World blog. Today's topic is going to be Noah's Ark. Back in February, the Associated Press announced a story about a new search for Noah's Ark at Mount Ararat on the border of Turkey and Syria and other political hotspots. Randall Price, the director of the new Center for Judaic Studies at Liberty University, the mind boggles about that, had announced that he was going to be going to look for the remains of Noah's Ark. Well, this is, of course, one of the favorite children's stories of all time, at least in our Western culture. There's a kind of a comfort, a security to being told that you are somehow special and that God is going to save you and protect you from the natural disasters that are going to encompass everybody else. We have wallpaper and children's bed clothes and all sorts of toys and stuffed animals that portray Noah's Ark for our children, and we present it as a comforting image to them. After all, we always cast ourselves in the role of Noah or one of his family members, one of those who's chosen to survive, and there's this very good feeling that we are in God's good graces, and that story is a story that touches us at a very deep level, I think, and people tend to stay with it and like to believe it. Of course, most of us do grow up and try to figure out what the story is really about if we have any interest in that sort of thing. Well, fantasy is really hard to cast off. If we face the fact, as even as adults, who wouldn't want to be given the divine directive to repopulate the entire world? I mean, it's a fantasy on many different levels that seems to work for people. But we know that it is really just a story. I remember as a child going to a theater to see a movie that was released in the 1970s entitled In Search of Noah's Ark. I was so enamored of the movie I bought the companion book, and I've got it here right in front of me. It is, of course, one of the Sun Pictures attempts to demonstrate the historical veracity of the Noah story. And the book goes through, as did the movie, lots of different forms of evidence that they believe verifies the Ark's presence on Mount Ararat and therefore proves the Bible to be true. They cite such authorities as Robert Ripley, and he is shown in the book version anyway. I can't recall if he was actually in the movie, but he's shown in the book posing next to a set of gigantic anchors, which obviously date from sometime in the early 19th or 20th centuries. And it is said to be Noah's Ark, the anchors to Noah's Ark that he is posing next to. The caption goes on to say, Robert Ripley has never been proven wrong. And of course, we all know Ripley from Ripley's Believe It or Not. Well, if you go through the book or any of the evidence that you see for the Ark, you'll notice that the photographic representations that you see, the alleged versions of the Ark that are perched somewhere precariously on top of Mount Ararat, you notice that none of them look alike. We've got several different varieties of Ark that are there, several different shapes that come into view. And again, this seems to be an attempt on the part of those who are unwilling to let go of the story to prove somehow that there must be an Ark there and therefore that the Bible is true. The 1970s movie was remade and re-released by Sun International Pictures in 1992. This was a little bit more of a classy version of the story. Hosted by Darren McGavin, this new film, entitled The Incredible Discovery of Noah's Ark, was a made-for-television movie that aired on CBS back in about 1992-93. They had upgraded the evidence considerably from the earlier version. Robert Ripley was no longer part of it, and they actually attempted to make it look scientific in many ways by choosing carefully selected PhDs whose credentials never included the institutions that they worked at or where they were granted their degrees, giving evidence that, yes, indeed, there could have been a worldwide flood, and yes, indeed, there could have been an ark that held every species that has ever been known to the planet. One of the eyewitnesses was a man named George Jamal, who was obviously of a Middle Eastern descent. And George Dumal tells his story in a very moving way about how he climbed the mountain and saw the Ark with a friend of his named Vladimir. Keep in mind, this is back in the days of the Soviet Union, and the Ark, of course, was a bone of contention at that point, being that, according to those who follow the Ark saga, it would have been considered a very bad thing by the Soviet Union to prove that a biblical story was actually true, so it was carefully guarded, so the story goes. In any case, Jamal tells the rather moving story of how he climbed the mountain with his friend, Vladimir, and they found the Ark, and they went inside, and they found cages, and once they found the cages, they used their pickaxes, because the Ark is way well above the snow line, and they chipped out a piece of wood, which he put in his pocket and managed to get back, even though moments later his friend Vladimir tragically fell to his death down a crevasse, and he was just too, and George Jamal was just too concerned to go on. He couldn't take any pictures. He was too distraught. In any case, in the interview, he pulls out this piece of wood and shows it to the audience and says, "This piece of wood is so precious and a gift from God." A very moving story. Several months later, after the production was aired, George Jamal came out and admitted that indeed his part in this whole documentary, as it was presented, was indeed a hoax. He was an actor, and he was never out Mount Ararat, and he never saw Noah's Ark. The piece of wood that he had was taken from his California home, soaked in some juices like lemon juice to make it look old, baked in an oven to age it artificially, and that the producers and directors of the documentary had never bothered to follow up on the reference and find out that indeed he was presenting a modern fable, if you will. Well, obviously that doesn't debunk every single case that is in the film. Although, if you watch it, as I used to show it to my students, so I've seen it several times, if you watch it, you notice the cracks in the various stories starting to emerge very clearly. The more times you see it, the more incredulous you become. All of it is very much part of the same movement that gives us creationism and that has given us the very dubious gift of fundamentalism in our culture. And these attempts to prove that the Bible is true often completely ignore the fact that we know quite a bit about the history of the Noah's Ark story, and to my mind, the actual history of the story is much more interesting than these fabricated accounts that are based on trips to a dangerous political zone in order to demonstrate that God is indeed reliable. The story begins for us, of course, in the 1870s. In the 1870s, it was a time when people were first starting to discover in the Western world that the Bible actually had an ancient context. Many ancient documents were being discovered in digs that were going on in the Middle East, and they were starting to be translated for the first time. An associate of the British Museum by the name of George Smith, in 1872, happened upon a tablet that he recognized after transcribing and translating bits of, to contain the story of the Great Flood. The difference here is that his flood story was not from the Bible, it was from the Gilgamesh epic. The tablet he was working on probably was dating to the Neo-Assyrian period, so maybe in the 700 to 800s BCE is the earliest. But it was still a shock when the world suddenly discovered that the Bible's account of the flood was not the only one. Later on, it was discovered that this story that Smith had been working on was probably copied from an even earlier version known as the Atrahasis epic, or Atrahasis story, which dates from about the 18th century before the Common Era, well before the biblical story could possibly have ever been written. The lines of convergence in these stories are rather striking. Both the stories have a protagonist, different names in the stories. In the Gilgamesh epic, the protagonist is known by the name of Utnapishtim. In the Bible, of course, he's known as Noah. In both accounts, the world is about to be punished because of its sinfulness. The people have become wicked, and so God slash the gods wish to wipe out everybody. One person is chosen, Utnapishtim or Noah, to survive the flood, and they're given the plans to build a boat by the gods themselves. They provide the actual plan, the dimensions, how it is to be built, instruct the boat builders to take aboard their families, the breeding population of humans, and two of each animal, sometimes more of certain varieties of animal to be sacrificed later, and that they are to go aboard the ark. They are to build a window in it, which is not an obvious feature that you would want in a vessel that's intended to survive a worldwide flood. And after the entire world is covered in both versions, after it rains for a long period of time, the ark eventually settles on top of a mountain. And once they're on top of the mountain, the inhabitants can look out the window and see that the water is flooded. And so, in both accounts, they start sending out birds to circle around until the world is dry. That way, they can find out when the water is gone completely. And after they finished their episode in the ark and they emerge in both the Gilgamesh version and the Atrahasis version and the Hebrew Bible account, they offer sacrifices to God or the gods. So the basic storyline is already there. Even down to some level of detail, it's clear that the author of the stories of Noah in the Hebrew Bible was at least aware of the tradition of the earlier version of the flood, which goes back even earlier, as we discovered later on, than the story of Atrahasis. There is a document from ancient Sumer, the earliest civilization that we know of. It's sometimes called the Eridu Genesis, named after the city it was found in and the fact that it has to do with the flood. I think that's a rather poor title, but it does indeed, again, reflect the bibliocentric view that we often have of the ancient world. The story is fragmentary and not nearly as complete as the later Babylonian versions are. But it tells the story of Zuisudra, who is the protagonist, and he is also instructed to build an ark by one of the Sumerian gods, Enki in this case, so that he may survive the flood. And what we have here is a basic pattern that started to emerge in the very earliest civilizations. The very earliest stories that we get, among the very earliest stories that we get, are the religious stories of the flood. It's a very ancient story, and it has passed down from the Sumerians to the Babylonians, through the Israelites to the Bible, and through the Bible to all of modern Christianity, and even to some extent, lesser extent really, Jewish readerships, and often is taken as fact. Now, we don't know why the story of the flood initially came about. It's one of those mysteries that we will never really completely understand. There have been a number of suggestions made, but nobody has actually been able to convince everybody else that they have the right answer as to why we have flood stories. It could be that the people who lived in Mesopotamia lived in flood plains. The Tigris and Euphrates valleys are prone to flood. Unlike the Nile, it's not as predictable, and sometimes the floods can be catastrophic and devastating. So perhaps that was it. We live on a flood-prone planet, and so we have stories about floods. It could also be moral issues or moral lessons that are involved. The ancient Sumerians and Babylonians were not an immoral people, as often presented. They were not debased or anything like that. They were an early and advanced civilization who believed that gods wanted the same thing that the God of the Hebrew Bible wants: people to behave well towards each other and treat the gods right. Basically, the desires of the ancient deities are the same. So perhaps there's a moral lesson here that as humanity grows in power and ability, it is also prone to greater and greater acts of evil. And so once civilization starts to get out of hand, then beware lest something cut you off. Well, we don't know the ultimate reason for the story, but it is still, even today, one of the most popular stories that we tell our children and that we continue to tell in various forms in the media. I never did hear if Randall Price ever got off the ground in his quest. The last news reports I've heard on the item date from February, so I don't know that he has actually made his trek to Mount Ararat, but I have no doubt that he eventually will. Even though he noted in an interview that the only thing holding him back was the money needed, some $60,000 for the equipment and other expenses that will take to go where he wants to go in order to excavate the way he wants to excavate to find the ark. But he probably will eventually end up going, because there is a great comfort in believing that you're the chosen one, or one of the chosen ones, even if that means that you have to take what was originally intended as a folktale or as a moral lesson to be, in some sense, historical fact.